Hello and welcome back to the Fall of the Roman Empire. It's Nick Holmes and this is episode 71 called Oh No, the Sasanians are back. In the last episode, we talked about the Emperor Anastasius, who I think was one of the most important but often ignored Eastern Roman emperors. He was important because he laid the foundations for the more famous Emperor Justinian's extraordinary reign when much of the Western Empire, including Rome itself, was reconquered. Last time we covered his crushing of the Isaurian revolt at the beginning of his reign and his reform of the tax system, which was the most important economic change in the Roman Empire since Diocletian's reforms 200 years before at the end of the 3rd century, a subject we covered a long time ago in episode 21. But there was a lot more that happened in Anastasius's reign, and one of the most important things was the return of an old enemy. Yes, we're talking about the Sasanian Persians. The Eastern Romans may have thought they could rest easy now that the Isaurians had been crushed and the Ostrogoths had left for Italy. But no, after a century of almost perpetual peace, Rome's old foe was back. Let's have a quick recap on Roman-Persian relations. As mentioned in previous episodes, one of the most important features of the 5th century, but one that is seldom talked about, was the almost 100 years of peace between Rome and Persia. You may recall that back in the 3rd century, Persia had burst upon the Roman world reinvigorated by the Sasanian dynasty, which took over from the weak Parthians, who were themselves one of the successor states to Alexander the Great's enormous empire. The Sasanians shocked the Romans by taking Antioch, one of the three largest Roman cities along with Rome and Alexandria, and in 260 by defeating the Emperor Valerian and turning him into a human footstool for the Persian Shah Shapur to mount his horse. Valerian was then flayed and his skin turned into a trophy in the Persian palace. But the Romans hit back hard. Diocletian's new Roman army restored Roman authority in the Middle East, and his successor, the Emperor Carus, sacked the Persian capital, Ctesiphon. Revenge for Valerian's humiliation was well and truly taken. But the Sasanians had yet another resurgence in the 4th century when Shapur II conducted an exhausting war with Constantine's sons, in which both sides suffered heavy losses. It was Julian the Apostate who decided to end the Persian problem forever by emulating Alexander the Great and advancing on Ctesiphon, but as you know, he failed to take the Persian capital and was then killed in battle in 363, an event that, to my mind, really marks the beginning of the fall of the Roman Empire. After that, everything went quiet for over 100 years. Why? Well, the reason was our friends from Asia, the Huns. While the Romans were battling with the Goths, who fled from the European Huns, another set of Huns appeared on the edge of eastern Persia, the White Huns. The White Huns, who are also often referred to as the Kidarites and Hephthalites, because these were the names of their two successive ruling dynasties, were similar to but quite separate from the European Huns, who were pushing the German tribes west. The term white is actually thought to denote geography rather than skin colour, because the Huns colour-coded their compass with white signifying the west, black the north, red the south, and blue the east. But it's worth noting that even before the White Huns arrived on the scene, Roman-Persian relations first began to improve when the European Huns raided through the Caucasus Mountains in 395. This alarmed the Persians sufficiently to make an alliance with the Romans to guard the Caucasus against further Hunnic invasions. The Persians built a series of defences in the Caucasus that came to be known as the Caspian Gates and included an enormous fortress that has survived largely intact to this day in Derbent in southern Russia. The result was that at the beginning of the 5th century, Rome and Persia even became partners, supporting each other against the encroaching barbarians. For example, the Persian Shah Yazdegerd, who reigned from 399 to 420, relaxed the anti-Christian laws the Sasanians had previously instituted, recognising the Nestorian Christian Church as a tolerated religion in Persia in 410. In return, the Eastern Emperor Arcadius even asked Yazdegerd to be the guardian of his son, the future Theodosius II. So, in contrast to the long and costly wars fought between Rome and Persia in the 3rd and 4th centuries, the 5th was almost entirely free of conflict. There were only two brief wars between the two great powers. The first, in 421-2, occurred when Yazdegerd's son Bahram V began a persecution of Christians in Persia in revenge for alleged Roman attacks on Zoroastrian temples. This tit-for-tat war only lasted a few months, and a Roman victory restored the peace. Another short war occurred in 440 over the Roman non-payment of gold to Persia to defend the Caucasus from Hunnic attack. The details are unclear, but the Romans had stopped paying what might have been as much as £500 of gold annually to the Persians, prompting Yazdegerd II to threaten war if the payment, which he termed tribute, was not made. Theodosius II was offended by the term tribute, and hostilities broke out. However, as with the previous war nearly 20 years before, there was no enthusiasm on either side to pursue it aggressively. The Romans quickly sought an end to hostilities by agreeing to some sort of payment to the Persians, which has never been specified. In their turn, the Sasanians, still under pressure from the White Huns, were only too happy to restore good relations. As a gesture of goodwill, both sides agreed to demilitarise their frontier in Mesopotamia. The only other conflict was in Armenia, which the Persians invaded in 451 when they defeated the Christian Armenians at the Battle of Avarayr. But Persian control of Armenia proved transitory. Although they tried to impose Zoroastrianism on the largely Christian population, this met with limited success, and in 484, the Armenians secured their independence and the right to Christian worship at the Treaty of Nevarsak. As attacks by the White Huns against Persia increased in the second half of the 5th century, Persia became less and less of a potential threat to Constantinople. In 484, matters came to a head when the Persian Shah Peroz was killed with most of the elite Persian cavalry in a Hunnic trap near Balkh in modern Afghanistan. The Roman chronicler Procopius has left us with a detailed description of the battle, in which the Huns dug a long trench concealed by vegetation and wood. They then charged at the Sasanian army, only to wheel around and feign a retreat. The Huns fled and retreated over the trench using a path they'd left raised. Completely unaware of this, the Persians galloped after the Huns along a wide front, hoping to outflank and surround them. Thousands of their elite armoured cavalry disappeared head first into the trench, impaling themselves on wooden spikes buried there. The slaughter was immense. Almost all the Persian cavalry were killed. Peroz and many of the Persian nobility also died. It was, in many ways, an equivalent of the Battle of Adrianople for the Persians. Because of this defeat, Sasanian Persia sank to its lowest ebb. It was forced to pay a heavy tribute to the White Huns and ceded its two major eastern cities, Herat and Merv, to them. Peroz's daughter was captured and forced to marry the Hunnic leader, Akshunwar. Two prominent Persian noblemen, Sukra and Shapur Miran, seized power and made first Peroz's brother, Balash Shah, and then his son, Kavad. Kavad is the focus of this episode because he was one of the most successful Sasanian monarchs and started a revival of Sasanian power that ultimately resulted in the most damaging of all contests between Rome and Persia, that of Heraclius and Chosroes II in the 7th century. But that's many episodes hence, and to begin with, Kavad's rise to power was long and arduous. He was only 15 in 488 when he was made Shah, and the nobleman Sukra was the real power behind the throne. Kavad's first task was to rid himself of Sukra. To do this, he sowed discord among the nobility, causing a civil war that led to the downfall and execution of Sukra, thereby enhancing his own power. His other main internal opponent was the powerful Magian priesthood, followers of Zoroaster, Persia's official religion. Kavad resorted to a remarkable strategy of supporting a fast-growing new cult among the lower classes, led by a controversial Zoroastrian priest called Mazdak. Mazdak was a religious and social revolutionary who preached that all men were equal and called for far-reaching political and social reforms. These included a communist-style sharing of property and even, according to some sources, their wives. By supporting a sort of 5th century hippie commune, Kavad certainly alienated himself from the establishment, but he went too far, and the nobility arrested and imprisoned him in the so-called Castle of Oblivion in Khuzestan. According to Procopius, Kavad's wife helped him escape by sleeping with the castle commander and suggesting Kavad then dress in her clothing and escape disguised as her. He was welcomed by thousands of his peasant supporters and ran away to the court of the Persians' great enemy, the White Huns. Kavad returned with a Hunnic army, having married the Hunnic leader Akshunwar's daughter, who was actually his niece since her mother was Kavad's sister, who had been forcibly married to Akshunwar. There's no mention of what happened to Kavad's other wife, who had bravely helped him escape from the Castle of Oblivion. Faced by the Huns, the Persian nobility capitulated and agreed to reinstate him and removed his brother Jamasp from the throne on the promise that neither Jamasp nor the Persian nobles responsible for Kavad's imprisonment would be punished. Our sources are vague, but it seems Kavad did not keep his promises. He blinded his brother, although he didn't actually kill him, and executed many of the nobility who were hostile to him. Kavad was certainly a capable politician, good at playing the nobles off against each other. But the danger for Persia was that Kavad was merely a puppet of the Huns. Yet duplicity was perhaps his major strength. While pretending to be a friend of the Huns, he was plotting against them. He would also in later years turn against his erstwhile supporters, the followers of Mazdak, and murder them in a most grisly fashion. So you didn't really want to mess around with Kavad. He was also extremely capable. To strengthen his position against both the Huns and his own nobility, he began a series of reforms that strengthened the Shah's authority. He centralised government and taxation by dividing the empire into four regions, with a military commander in charge of each one, reporting to him. He undermined the nobility's power by sponsoring the Deccan, a new class of small landowning magnates who provided a professional cavalry force managed and paid for by him. This reduced his dependence on the heavy cavalry provided by the nobility, a feudal force called the Wazirgan, which had formed the backbone of the Sasanian army for centuries. He also reduced the power of the Magi by establishing a new priestly office to help the poor and underprivileged. This ensured he remained popular among the peasantry, something he'd originally achieved by supporting Mazdak and his followers. But for the time being, he still depended on the White Huns for their military muscle to maintain his authority. And to keep their support, he needed gold. A lot of gold. It was this which led him into conflict with the Romans, since he saw war against the Eastern Empire as a way of meeting a number of his aims. First, raising gold to appease the Huns, second, testing out his new army, and third, building his own reputation as a national champion against the hated Romans. So Cavad cast aside all the ingredients that had underpinned an unprecedented century of peace between Rome and Persia. In 502, he led a combined force of Persians and White Huns into Armenia, breaking the 100-year peace treaty that had been signed 80 years previously in 422. The invasion took the Emperor Anastasius by surprise. The fortress city of Theodosiopolis fell into Persian hands on the first attack, either through treachery or simply because the garrison was undermanned. Cavad marched south to Martyropolis, where its governor surrendered and gave the Persians 2 years' worth of taxes, provided they didn't sack the city. Cavad kept his word and advanced to the important Roman city of Amida, located in modern southeastern Turkey. There he met stiff resistance and strong walls built over 250 years before by the Emperor Constantius II. Battering rams couldn't dent them, and when the Persians built an artificial hill beside the walls, the besieged inhabitants tunnelled underneath it and caused it to collapse. The city held out in this way for 4 months, from October 502 until January 503, when Procopius says the Persians were in such abject despair they were about to march off until all the city's inhabitants lined the walls to jeer at them. Deeply offended, the Persians decided to stay and finish the job. Their opportunity arose when some monks entrusted with the defence of one of the towers drank so much wine one night celebrating a religious festival, they didn't notice the Persians scaling the walls. The monks were butchered and the city was subjected to a hideous massacre, although many of its inhabitants were reportedly saved by a brave priest who confronted Cavad and told him such slaughter was beneath the dignity of so brave and great a king. Cavad's pride was flattered and he called a stop to the killing. The survivors were led away into captivity in Persia or allowed to stay and tend to the Persian garrison. Anastasius may have been taken by surprise, but his response was quick and determined. According to the Roman sources, 52,000 soldiers were mobilised against the Persians and began a major offensive in May 503, led by three generals, Ariobindus, Hypatius, and Patricius. Unfortunately, none of them got on, and since Anastasius didn't appoint a commander-in-chief, the result of this great offensive was disappointing. An advance on the Persian fortress of Nisibis by Ariobindus with 12,000 men was beaten off, and an attempt to retake Amida with a much larger army of 40,000, led by Hypatius and Patricius, was also pushed back by the Persians. Anastasius quickly sorted out the disagreements at the top of the army. He sacked Hypatius and appointed Celer, an experienced Illyrian soldier who was head of the Imperial Guard, as supreme commander. The Roman army was probably larger than the Persian, since it's likely Anastasius sent most of the two Praesentil armies that were still stationed around Constantinople to support the field army of the Aurians, meaning that the Romans had three of their five field armies facing the Persians. This would fit well with the number of 52,000 Roman soldiers, since a field army had between 15,000 to 20,000 men. And this would not have included garrison troops, the Limitanii, meaning the Romans may have had up to 100,000 troops in total on the Eastern Front. Meanwhile, Cavad focused his attention on taking the fortified city of Edessa. It was particularly significant because of a legend dating back to the days of Jesus Christ, who had apparently promised the citizens their city would never be taken by an enemy. This was because Abgar, the then prince of Edessa, and a close friend of the emperor Augustus, had invited Jesus to leave Palestine, where he said the Jews would never accept him, and live in Edessa. Because of this, the Christian population started massacring the local Jews, afraid they might try to deliver the city to the Persians to prove the prophecy wrong. Rather more helpfully, Ariobindus headed there with his troops and garrisoned the city strongly. Cavad's attacks on its walls were easily repulsed. When the Persians had been beaten back, Ariobindus delivered a message to Cavad saying, quote, "Now thou seest that the city is not thine, nor of Anastasius, but it is the city of Christ who blessed it, and it has withstood thy hosts." End quote. Another less prominent source says Ariobindus paid Cavad £2,000 of gold to retreat. But whatever the truth, the Persians were now losing the war in the face of Anastasius's superior forces. Keller and Ariobindus invaded Persian Armenia and devastated many Persian-held towns. Patricius advanced to besiege Amida. The siege became protracted and lasted throughout the winter of 504 to 505. Both the garrison and what remained of the Roman population began to starve to death. One source has left a particularly grisly story that people, quote, "used to go forth by stealth into the streets of the city in the evening or in the morning, and whomsoever they met, woman or child or man, for whom they were a match, they used to carry them by force into a house and kill them, and then eat them either boiled or roasted." End quote. The Persians apparently found out about this cannibalism when they smelt cooking. They instituted a death penalty but allowed the corpses still to be eaten. Finally, the Persian garrison surrendered, although its commander cleverly struck an agreement with Patricius to let them go unharmed and with £1,000 of gold in their pockets. Anastasius had broken Cavad's offensive. Amida had been recovered. Persian Armenia was largely in Roman hands. Meanwhile, Cavad was not only losing the war, but he had to deal with the breakdown of his peace with the White Huns. He offered Keller an armistice. A truce was agreed in 507 to last for 7 years. In fact, it lasted for longer than that. Anastasius strengthened Roman defences along the eastern frontier. In particular, he built a large fortified town at Dara, close to the Persian fortress of Nisibis. He named it Anastasiopolis, but in later years it reverted to its original name of Dara. Replete with a gigantic citadel, storehouses, cisterns, and even public baths, it would become the site of one of Belisarius's most famous battles. Anastasius may have won the first round in this new conflict with Persia, but a tragic new era had begun. Rome and Persia had returned to their perennial and pointless struggle. The irony was that the previous century of peace had benefited both of them. From now on, the resumption of war would cause nothing but death and destruction. And that ends this episode. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. And in the next episode, which will be in 2 weeks' time on the 25th of November, we'll hear more about Anastasius's reign. And in the meantime, if you like the podcast, you must check out my website at nickholmesauthor.com. Link in the show notes, where you'll find lots of free extra resources linked to the podcast, like maps and blogs, and there's even a free ebook. So do head there now. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.